Yes, I can hear you fine, and I just started the recording. It's just now, 6:30.
Yeah, it was. No, you're wrong.
Oh, I'm wrong?
Yeah, I watched it.
Okay.
I mean, I can watch it. I'll double check, but
okay, no, that's fine.
Only one person said no.
Okay.
Another person, I think, was like saying like didn't imply that they were going to vote yes,
okay,
but didn't actually vote no.
Okay.
That's how, my recollection of it. I'll watch it again now.
You want to give it a, did you hear from Silas? You know, Joe's on the line.
Hi, Joe.
Has anyone called me?
Let me check.
Well, I called to the
Well, if anybody called me, I have not, I did not get a voicemail. And I do not have an email.
So now I'm getting a call.
Okay. Are we online, Bill?
He already started the recording.
Okay. So we will call our Planning Commission meeting for March 15th, 2022 to order at 6:31. Will everyone please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, our roll call. Commissioner Huggins.
Yes.
Present. Commissioner Johnson.
Present.
Present. Commissioner Freiberger.
Present.
Present. Commissioner Fattizi is present. Commissioner Maddox. Not online. Absent. Commissioner Frenette?
Present.
Yeah, and Commissioner Penno?
Present.
Here we go. So has everyone had the opportunity to review the meeting minutes from June 18th? Let's start there.
January
18th? June.
I'm sorry, January 18th. I'm wishing it's June. You're right.
So,
yeah.
Okay, Commissioner, let's the online go first. Commissioner Frenette?
Something doesn't add up with the chairman and vice chairman motion passing.
Specifically?
It says 5-1, but it's listed as 5-2.
I have it listed as 5-1. Motion passed 5-1 on the...
But if you read the names, the no's have two.
There's two no's, but it says one.
You know, John went through that.
I'll have to double check that.
Okay. I caught the same thing, by the way.
I'll go back and watch the minutes on that. And,
as did I, yeah.
Okay.
And get that corrected. And as long as I get it corrected, can we just call it good? Or
Yeah. I was just going to have a motion to approve with the change.
I had one other more question than anything. For the public hearing, the second paragraph, the motion, it said the third line with the amendment to striking from section 1721, I think. Of striking or to strike, it doesn't make sense to me, but perhaps it's minor.
I'll fix the grammar, but it doesn't change the intent.
Okay.
And since we're picking out details here, the top of it says meeting held remotely via Zoom. If recollection recalls, that one was actually in person, didn't we?
Not January.
I'm pretty sure when we met, this one was in person. Because I thought we went in person, then we went back to Zoom.
I know we did the vote and we were sitting here. It was a hybrid meeting.
Yeah.
Not for the January one?
For the January one. Yeah. The February one was Zoom. I remember that.
Right, because I was disappointed that February we went back to full-on remote. But January, we were definitely here.
Well, none of those are significant.
No.
No.
So we'll just get the right information, and if the Planning Commission wants to make a motion with those three to fix, let me know.
Okay, so at this moment, I would like a motion to approve with modifications the January 18th, 2022 meeting minutes.
I so move.
We have a motion by Commissioner Freiberger. Do I have a second?
Second.
We have a second by Commissioner Penno. So the motion carries, and let's go on to February 15th, 2022. Any comments, anyone?
I would move to approve the Planning Commission minutes for February 15, 2022.
Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
We have a motion to approve by Commissioner Johnson, a second by Commissioner Freiberger. The motion is approved and carries. So on to the general.
Usually you vote after you have a motion and a second.
Wait, say that again.
Usually you vote after having a motion and a second.
Everyone, thank you. Everyone in favor of the 1-18-2022 motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. For the February 15th, 2022.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. I apologize. I'm still refining some of my process here. So on to the general public comments. So I will open the general public comments at 6:37. Is there anything that was submitted to staff, email or anything else? Nothing? Do we have anyone online that would like to comment during this segment of the meeting?
I don't see anybody online.
I don't see anybody.
Joe Furnett.
So I will close the general public comments at 6:38. So, John, would you like to do an introduction for our public hearing segment that is coming up right now?
All right. So since there's nobody online and nobody in the audience that hasn't heard about this, I'll spare the Planning Commission a lengthy overview of what you've been working on. So we had a pretty good discussion at the last Planning Commission meeting about the proposed amendments to the Design Review Standards and Guidelines Manual to address development and building modifications in the Central Business District. After several meetings and several iterations, we took the Planning Commission's feedback and plus a few things that I panicked about while thinking about this in bed various nights and tried to address everything. The idea was for today's to be a perfect project, perfect rendition that the Planning Commission could approve. But if not, hey, no big deal. We've been working on this a long time. We can work on it longer and make sure it's perfect. It needs to be perfect. If you haven't read through it and you're like, I don't know, or if you've read through it and you're confused, or if you just disagree for whatever reason, now is the time, even if you're unsure, now is the time to let us know before we totally go forward and make this the final product.
So what were the highlights of what we changed this time? I don't know that we specifically pointed out in the memo the specific items that we changed. So I will go through. So we added a definition of dental work. We added an illustration of that. We clarified the difference between a mullion and a mountain. Mullion and mountain, if you have any questions. Nicole did a great graphic on it in the last page, second to last page of the document itself. Mullions are the things like in the window, and a mountain is the post in between two windows that are put together. So like those behind you, there's two windows. There's probably 4 feet or 5 feet in between those. That probably doesn't count as a mountain or a, that probably does not count as a mountain. But if they were pushed right up against each other and there was just a little, you know, 6-inch band, that would be a mountain. So what else do we call mullions? You know, that stick, the stick work in a window might also be, there's other terms that are used. Huh? Yeah. So that was one of the things that we cleared up. We gave definitions of modulation and articulation, according to Nicole. And you can speak up and speak to them yourself. If you, modulation. So hopefully the modulation makes it agrees with the way that Mr. Huggins felt it was should read. We gave an illustration of modulation. Nicole did most of the work. I just gave her my notes and looked it over. Gave an illustration of Art Nouveau and False Front. We used local examples, by the way. I don't know if you noticed. So as to not be just stealing things off the internet.
No, I noticed, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, totally.
So Nicole also went and took most of those pictures on a day that was not too rainy. We moved modulation and articulation of windows. Shall architecturally respect the modulation and articulation of the adjacent buildings to standards. It was under guidelines. We cleaned up under the standards section under general storefront. The number five there, there was some, the language was a little iffy about incorporate at least of the five following elements listed A through J, and then in below list at least one K through P. So hopefully that makes more sense now. If not, let us know. We came up with more marquee, canopy, and awning. Pictures, information, descriptions. We found some great information on that and was able to incorporate that in. We were unable to find any canopies in our town, which kind of makes sense because the way the description of a canopy is it's adjacent to the building, but it can either be separate from the building or adjacent to the building on one end,
but it will be supported by legs or some other sort of support on the side away from the building, whereas an awning just hangs off. It's cantilevered. Mm-hmm. A canopy requires something at its other end to hold it up. So if you've ever seen any movies or TV shows where they're in New York City and there's some fancy apartment buildings with a doorman outside and there's a big round canopy that goes out like almost all the way to the curb so one can get out of their limo and not get wet and there'll be a doorman there. Those are often canopies because they have legs on the other side. We wouldn't really want canopies, to be honest with you, and I kind of kicked around the idea of not allowing canopies because we don't want those legs protruding and getting in the way in our central business district. However, if somebody wanted to make it look like Fifth Avenue, who are we to say they can't do that? So I don't know which way to go with it.
It makes more sense for multifamily structures like apartment buildings and things like that. That's where you see a lot of that. But not here. I get it.
So anyway, that was one of the things. We added transom windows and wainscoting to the definitions parts. And I feel I made one other panicked move that I thought we needed to do, and I'm blanking on it right now. Oh, we made a lot of changes about roof pitch. And why don't I direct you to that section? That's also going to be under general storefront, or general building frontage, I believe is where we put it. Is that correct?
Under standards.
General storefront page.
So page 8.
Yeah, I'll try this one top.
Thank you for your finding that for me. Mm-hmm. Starting with number 7, added buildings in the downtown core. So that's the area that we often refer to as within the blue line. It's the historic area. And Ferry Street and State Street and any part of Metcalf Street is the core. Broke this out into several different ways to look at this. So the buildings in the downtown core shall have traditional commercial flat roofs with parapets or roofs with a pitch low enough to be obscured by a parapet. So what we're saying is if you look at every building in the downtown core area, all of them except for 2 have flat roofs or a flat enough roof where a parapet obscures it mostly, at least from the front. The 2 buildings that do not is the library. It has kind of 2 shed roofs. It's not a peaked roof. It's not a gable roof. It's more like 2 shed roofs. So you see a lot of roof line on that building. So I want to be very clear that the library would not meet this design standard. Aside from that one, the Whidbey Island Bank, or Heritage Bank, or whatever it is, it's closed now, has traditional hip roof, which, hip roof is, it's like a gable. So you got a pitched roof with gables on 2 ends. The hip roof would be, so you got your pitched roof, and you take away those gables on each end and put more pitches to it. So they kind of like a salt box where it has 4 pitches on each side. It has no gables. Right. Yeah. We've eliminated the gables and replaced it with 2 more pitches. So the Whidbey Island Bank has hip roof. Aside from that, the old marketplace has a ridiculous roof line that when you approach from the west, looking east at it, is roof. When it was redone as Marketplace, Pioneer Marketplace,
they went through a lot of effort to put up a large parapet to help obscure that. Now, you can't really do a whole lot with a building with a roof that big designed and still block it. So they did what they could to give it the parapet look. So my thought process was, and you can have a different thought process, was just about every building, except for those two, have parapets and on all of their frontages. So that seems like a theme that Cedar Willie wants or should keep intact. Mm-hmm. Ironically, the other place that, I guess it's not in the downtown core, but it's on Metcalf, is this building. So we've got kind of a flat roof. So this building would pretty much work. Across the street, there's, you know, Silas's house is a normal house. The new live work units have pitched roofs, so they would be affected by this the way it's written. You know, you wouldn't have been able to do that in that location. So State Street, if you go all the way down State Street to Highway 9, they would not be able to. They would not be able to do this. They would have to have flat roofs. So that's really pushing. That's kind of pushing beyond what we've historically seen. But I think it's important for us to discuss because this is new and this is pretty big. So before I finish up with this discussion of it, shed roof in that area, still under number 7, shed roofs may be used for subordinate roof forms such as porches, canopies, and upper floor projections. So this building has an upper floor projection, so that's okay. You know, that's not the main roof. In the pictures in here there's another great subordinate roof picture that Nicole took on page. Where'd it go? I know it's here. I thought it was in definitions, but maybe not. Help me out, Nicole. Okay, page 6, the Cascade Fabrics building. So that's got a basically an awning up on the third floor. That's a shed roof. It's subordinate. Totally good.
It was probably added to the original building before, I suspect.
I don't know. That's interesting. Quite interesting. I would have assumed it was at the main time, but when it was built, but maybe not. So that's what number 7 says. Number 8 dials it back a little. But it's not referring to the core anymore. So buildings over 2 stories in any part of the central business district but outside the downtown core shall have traditional commercial flat roofs with parapets, low pitch roofs that are obscured by a parapet, or may have a shed roof with a minimum of a 3-foot eave on the street facing side. All roofs except shed roofs described above shall include a parapet on all sides. So what that says is you can do shed roofs or flat roofs anywhere in the CBD if you're 2 stories, if you're over 2 stories. So that's a tall building. That one I might stick to my guns on, because once you start to get 3 stories or taller, my impression is that it should be a commercial multifamily, traditional multifamily looking building, not a 3-story apartment building. So not that 3-story apartment buildings can look bad. The ones over there across the street from Cascade Middle School next to the subway outpost, that's 3 stories. I believe that has kind of a mix of hip roof. I don't think it has a gable on that one. I can't say for sure, but that would not be allowed in the CBD, even though it looks okay.
the way this is written. We would be encouraging it to be more of a flat roof like the rest of our downtown if you go over three stories. Now, I don't know how many three-story buildings are going to be built in the CBD outside of the downtown core or the main drag. Because now we're talking about like off of Borseth Street or Rita Street. Maybe on Puget Street, you know, two blocks over, or Murdoch, maybe. So these are big changes. And then the third part of this is, so we've talked about in the downtown core, and we've talked about outside of the downtown core and over two stories. The final one is two stories or less in the CBD outside of the downtown core. May have traditional flat roofs with parapets, roofs with a pitch low enough to be obscured by a parapet, shed roofs with at least 2 foot eave or gabled or hipped roofs having a slope between 4 and 12 and 12 and 12 with a minimum of 2 foot eaves. So that's allowing for just about every roof style. If you're two stories or less, everywhere outside of the downtown core. But it does require eaves because buildings without eaves aren't always the best looking. But if you disagree, these are your recommendations. That was my recommendation to you. Now, staff wrote this without a whole lot of input from you guys on this particular issue. So we're not going to have any hard feelings if you feel like you need to dial it back or want to do something different. It's just a suggestion, and I guess I am kind of a little bit I'm a little bit iffy about requiring flat roofs on outside of the downtown core itself along State Street and certain parts of Metcalf Street and Ferry. That's the one thing that, now that I've written in and thought about it more, maybe.
Well, I haven't even opened up the public hearing yet, which I'll open and close after this, since nobody's here. And then we can open the discussion after that, just as a point of procedure.
That does conclude my discussion of the changes that we've made since you've last seen this. So now would be a great time.
Okay, so I would like to open the public meeting portion of the proposed updates to Chapter 3, Additional Standards for the Central Business District, and Chapter 11, Definitions of the Cedro Woolley Design Review Standards and Guidelines Manual at 6:58 p.m. Is there anyone in attendance in the audience or online? Okay, I will close the public hearings portion at 6:58 since no one is in attendance and we did not have any input that was submitted to staff prior to the meeting as well. Okay, open for discussion. Thank you, John, by the way. Good job.
You can't hear him.
Sorry. In the CBD district, it's great. I just wanted to make the comment that the new Northwest style, which this building doesn't qualify, but like Silas's buildings across the street probably and the new library, those buildings mostly are designed to solve problems that from the old Northwest style of design. And so anyway, I'd like to be able to see the pitch roofs outside of the historic buildings and the CBD blue line because a lot of the things that are going to be done are going to be done in the new Northwest style. The new Northwest style has pitch roofs for a reason. It has tilted posts holding up buildings for a reason, and it's made out of the materials it's made out of for a reason, because it answers, you know, problems that we have here in the Northwest, like rot and rain drip and posts rotting off and all of those kinds of things. So anyway, I agree with John. I think that as long as it stays within the historic part of old downtown, the flat roofs is a good idea, or low slope roofs are a good idea. But when we get out of that, we want to open up the possibilities to design buildings that are, you know, better energy efficiency, better handling of water, better preservation of the materials that the building is made of after it's built. So that's all I'll say about that.
You know, the new library looks great. I mean, it really does. I live right across the street, yeah. And they put a lot of thought into it. Yeah. And a lot of the concepts that you just spoke about, yeah. they incorporated in that building in particular.
Yeah, and I've gone down there on rainy days and windy days. My daughter works there, so. But anyway, I've gone down there on days when it was pretty sloppy out and stuff like that, and seen the whole thing working, and it's really awesome. And some of these old buildings, you know, you can't do that with them, or it'd be very a lot of effort put into making them function in the same way. So anyway, I don't want to mess with the historic look of downtown, and I think within the CBD this is reasonable to ask that of the owners of the buildings, but outside of that we want to make sure that we can stay current with energy efficient design and buildings that preserve materials better. So right, thank you.
Anyone else? Nicole?
This is
Danielle. Nicole already spoke. I'm sorry.
I got.
Did somebody say something?
No. I just asked if you had any comments on it, because typically you're really good at going through the details.
Well, I thought of a couple more definitions, but I didn't want to disrupt the flow of moving forward with this. And when I saw John's other kind of major changes, I was going, did I not see those before? So I'm glad to know that you had added those on the pitches and everything. That's kind of a bit to think about. But I guess at least on the parapet part of it, if we already have that, it makes sense to require it. Though it's kind of interesting that several of our major buildings do not have that are kind of iconic, City Hall and library.
So the buildings that, so the library and the buildings over here are not in the downtown core. So if the Planning Commission, as Mr. Huggins had alluded to, want to do something to the effect of drawing back that flat roof requirement to truly be just in the downtown core and not on the main streets that kind of wag out from it, that would be an easy solution. We go back to page 8 and number 7. All we have to do is strike out one phrase, and it would be buildings in the downtown core, which would be changed to the area bordered by the tracks to the west, Puget Street to the east, the tracks to the north, and Warner Street to the south, and end it there. And that's the traditional blue line. So we're talking, you know, basically Northern Street up here, the tracks over there, in between Marketplace and the library, south to Warner Street, which is one block south of State Street. So that would make sure that everything on State Street has to follow these rules. And to the east, on Puget Street, which is the block block east of Murdoch. So this is Metcalf. The other side of the building is Murdoch. The next street over is Puget. That's where Howmack is. So we would continue to define in that area.
and require flat roofs. Your mic on.
I keep turning it off. I'm sorry. And all of the other standards would apply within that blue line as well. And
well, let me think about that. This was written just with the concept of the roofs being in the downtown core. The rest of the design standards would apply to all of the central business district.
Okay.
Could be a can of worms, really. Mm. I mean, if you want to start thinking about design standards being different outside of the central business, outside of the core, which, in all truth, in all fairness, if somebody comes to our building department with a duplex proposal on Rita Street outside of the blue core, these kind of go out the window a little bit because, you know, it's not a big commercial building in a highly visible area. So we're pretty lenient on the design standards. Mm-hmm. But if somebody comes in and wants to do something on State Street outside of the blue, we're going to have much higher standards because it's highly visible. That is the entrance to our downtown core. It is the heart of our city, and it's highly visible to 20,000 or so cars a day, I believe, go through on State Street. Is that still accurate, Mark? I don't know if you're paying attention, if you're listening or not.
I'm sorry, John.
Do you know about how many cars drive on State Street per day still? Last I saw, I was like,
yeah, it's 8,000 to 9,000 east of Highway 20, and slightly less than that west of Highway 20, but it's fairly high.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Wow. Yeah. So there's a lot of vehicles on that. Ferry's not quite like that, but I mean, ferry really does feel like the entrance to our community, more so than State Street, even in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that when designing these standards, I wanted, you know, I really envisioned what's going to happen on the old Ford dealership. You know, it's a vacant lot.
Took the words right out of my mouth. Yep.
So I'm envisioning a continuation of our central business district. Mm-hmm. However, if we want to, I mean, does the Planning Commission think it's important to make it look like Metcalf Street with historic brick parapet flat roofs? Or do you feel like that's an area where we could allow more current styles like the Northwest style that would be kind of a mishmash? This building, that projecting roof part is very much Northwest style. The bricks, the angles, not necessarily stucco, but sometimes stucco. Exposed wood beams always look nice, but, you know, doesn't have the flat roof. The library falls somewhere in the new Northwest style. It doesn't have enough eaves really to be a true Northwest style building because usually there's large projections with the eaves on those buildings, and that one has short eaves.
Yeah.
So what is the Planning Commission's vision for these entries to our community? Yeah. It's an important question.
Yeah. I wanted to clarify my point too. So the real thing that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to walk a line because about, I'm trying to remember when, probably about 2006, 7, 8, somewhere in there, we were working on housing element. And we had this same lengthy discussion about roof pitches. But then it was about residential areas. And we were saying that we didn't want any more flat roofs in the city in residential areas, and that wasn't just me. That was all the planning commissioners, because we've either worked on them or do it, or they live in one like I do, which is a low slope, and it's a disaster in Washington, in western Washington. And so we were saying, you know, houses should have at least a 3-12 pitch for houses. But then in downtown, we have the issue where we have the building, the big buildings are historic buildings are all pretty much low slope or flat. And so where do we draw that line, or how do we ease that into the housing one, which I think still clearly states that you have to have a pitched roof of at least 3-12. At least it was in there at one point in the housing element. So so that's all I'm trying to do is not walk the pitched roofs all the way back, but yet keep the historic look of downtown. So anyway, that's what's in my mind.
So just for my own mental imagination here, so still kind of keeping the parapet look, just having the sloped roofs versus flat roofs.
Well, commercial buildings. So for commercial buildings, they usually have more money in the projects, you know, so they can build membranes and they can do all this really fancy stuff. The membranes and stuff I've seen put on houses and stuff are not particularly good and don't last well, and you end up with big leak problems. But anyway, I'm not trying to change the downtown. I'm just saying, is where do we draw the line? At what point are we holding back better design for the Northwest, you know, to keep our historic, our downtown looking historic, I guess is what I'm saying. So I'm not trying to change anything with the old buildings that are actually historic, but what about when new buildings come in, either inside the blue line or just outside the blue line, and they want to do them in whatever style, and they don't want to put a low slope roof because, you know, they can collect water a different way, or they can shed water a different way, or a better way, or whatever, you know. So my training is as an architect, so I like to leave as much wiggle room for engineers and architects to do their thing, you know. They it's all they do, so they tend to think things through pretty well. So anyway, that's the spot I'm trying to find is.
Do you see a difference between a two-story building and a three-story building?
Yeah, because the lower the stories, the more visible the pitched roof. You know, if you're over three stories, it doesn't matter whether it's pitched or not. You're never going to see it from the street. So, so as you're driving in and going down the street, it doesn't matter whether it has a pitched roof or not. Under three stories, you are going to see the roof pitch if you don't put up a parapet in the front or a false front, or whatever you want to call it, to hide it. And, you know, one story, you can probably actually see the roof even if it's flat, unless it has a parapet. So,
I'm thinking you want some continuity between the transition between the existing older downtown and anything new that's going in. So that's a kind of fine line we're kind of walking here right now.
Yeah. I guess, so we're talking about the same thing. That's why I brought it up again, because you're saying, where do we want the buildings to look historic? Do we want to run the historic thing down both sides of East State Street? Do we want to run it down both sides of East Ferry? I guess it's East Ferry. West Ferry and West State. So so it does matter, you know. And I don't have a problem with that. I think we've talked about that before on the Planning Commission too, making those two street corridors from Highway 9 east into our downtown all conform to the historic image, at least along the street fronts, and then back in behind, and the blocks back behind it can be whatever. So I'd be in favor of that. I'd go along with that concept. And we also talked about how far east to go, you know, down Ferry Street, and then that got kind of became an interesting topic just because you have so many houses and people started showing up curious about, you're not going to tear my house down and put up a commercial building, are you? And it's like, no, we were just talking about the, you know, as the city expands. So anyway. So that's my vote for that. I would be fine with extending the the look of downtown, the CBD's blue line down Ferry and straight State to 9, just along the both sides of those streets. To
well, and as it mentioned here, you can hide a pitched roof behind a false front, so kind of precluding that when flat roofs are not really terribly practical around here. Mm-hmm. Seems kind of, as Pat said, kind of goes against how people build things nowadays for tolerating the weather.
That's kind of what I was trying to get at, too, was so you keep the look, but, I mean, the parapet essentially hides it to begin with. So, yeah, why necessarily, you know, blanket yourself and cause everything to be flat roofed outside of the blue line as well when it's not necessarily necessary, given that it's not visible at a certain point?
Yeah, there's really no math involved. You can show the planning department that your building's roof is not going to show with a facade and a line drawn. You know, you can show that your parapet is going to block the whatever kind of roof you put behind it, so that when they're looking at it from the street, you're not going to see it. If you're in an airplane, you're going to know. So,
the idea was. The idea behind the way it was written, and you know, maybe it didn't get the point across, or maybe it's not written the way it could be, was if you're doing a three-story building, I imagine you're going to do something with a parapet and a flat roof anyway, mm-hmm. and you really should, because otherwise it doesn't look historic. So that's why I didn't feel like there was any heartache about that once you're over three stories. And then that's anywhere, CBD core or outside of the core, everywhere. And then the requirement for a parapet to block the roof would apply to everything in the CBD now, and then extended down State, extended down West Ferry, and extended up Metcalf. If that's too much, we can massage this around to make it a little easier. Because, yeah, it would, the way it's written, because the library's on State Street, these would not allow that.
But the library is grandfathered in, right?
Yeah,
it is. But it puts
a building like it's just illustrative mm-hmm. of how these would apply to a big project that would someone might bring to town and mm-hmm. say, "Well, you can't do that."
Mm-hmm.
The library is under three stories, though. We're just talking about three stories.
Doesn't
above.
Matter.
Oh, it it's doesn't a, matter. Okay.
I mean, the way this is written, it's on State Street.
Period.
So
we're not distinguishing between the two. Or
roofs visible on State Street, Ferry Street, or mm-hmm. Metcalf Street.
So now I'm going
to... gone too far. I'm happy to draw it back.
Well, now I'm going to really go out in the weeds. But so if our brand-new library decided to expand, would they then have to update the entire look to have a sloped roof? Right. Or Silas's. I mean, Silas's buildings to me are beautiful. They're beautiful, and I can't imagine having to change them to something different just because we suddenly change the requirements to do the thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the curse of unintended consequences. You know, the idea was not to... I wasn't thinking about the Abbott's Alley, but they would not be allowed to be there under these rules. Yeah. They wouldn't allowed to be there under these rules if they were anywhere in the downtown because they're three-story. Mm-hmm. So thus they would require a flat roof.
So what happens when you have a flat roof and you want to put up solar panels? Right, you have a flat roof, but you can have a...
You just
tilted...
engineer it.
So that wouldn't apply to any of the things
downtown
where...
Downtown 48 has...
It does. It has a whole...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has solar on top.
Yeah.
And remind me, so, because I mean, there's a little bit of nuance between downtown and the blue line downtown core. So are we currently in the CBD at all right now?
No.
Because I almost feel like...
this is public land.
Because I almost feel like...
But the CBD runs all up here.
Runs all the way to...
And along, and okay. The antique shops along there, I think, are in the CBD.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that kind of what I'm my mind's trying to get at is like there's almost like a different nature to those different offshoots. Like I do kind of feel like West State and West Ferry almost is like an extension of the downtown and probably should, you know, resemble that core characteristic. But once you get past Metcalf heading east on both of those streets, then you're kind of transitioning. It's more of a transition now into, you know, residential. And then when you get north of the old, you know, train tracks heading north on Metcalf, there again, you're kind of, I mean, this is almost like a no man's zone for style. Cause I mean, you kind of got like an industrial feel. You got like you got the public property, you got a park, you got residential. I mean, it's kind of like a whole patchwork of kind of different and natured properties.
Aside from the three properties right here, you know, the residential house, Abbott's Alley, and then the lawyer
building. McCann's.
Mm-hmm. Aside from those three, everything up and down here is a flat roof.
Mm-hmm.
So that still is kind of the style along here too. So this is the line of thought. Where does what is the Planning Commission's vision for development along here? Like before this building went here, this was kind of no man's land over here, right? And now all of a sudden it's become a more popular place where people are walking and going to with the park and Abbott's Alley is developed. Coho is a popular spot for people to visit. You know, if the old Skagit building would be redeveloped, that's very possible for that to happen. Someone finally just decide to go in there, or he decides to sell it for just to get rid of it, and somebody redevelops it because they get it at a good cost. I mean, it's very possible that large swaths of this area, large swaths of West Ferry Street will develop and become the new vibrant part of the city. And so what does the Planning Commission want it to look like? Do you want it to look more modern Pacific Northwest style, which is absolutely beautiful and wonderful? Or does the Planning Commission's vision for those streets fill more of the historic Metcalf Street, which would be artificial because that part of town never was like that. But as cities grow, you want to have your design ideas to encourage what that new development's going to look like. So it's your chance to put a stamp on what the city is going to look like in the future.
Those are big parcels, too, land-wise. Yeah.
They're very developable.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't say this to try and curtail anybody's ideas. The Planning Commission in 2005 to 2008, again, because we finished the update in 2005, at that time, when we talked about this exact same issue of do we go out State Street, do we go out State Street, do we go out Ferry Street, and do we come up Metcalf to the highway, and we came up with two or three things that were kind of like givens, and one was that the lighting that is down Metcalf Street that standard continue up to the end of the street and hopefully go out Ferry and State, so that the lighting was something that held the entire downtown together. But you can do that lighting with whether you're New Northwest or Gothic or whatever the heck style of architecture you decide. But anyway, that was one thing. And then I don't think we ever came to a conclusion about what to do with the buildings, because it's, like John said, it's pretty complex. You got a lot of stuff. You've got the big flat roof buildings. We've already got some newer style stuff like Silas's houses on the street there. But that was one of the things that we talked about was the light standards, the grading standards, you know, like the sewer caps and all that kind of stuff. And the city hall did it out here. You know, we have the nice lights and the grills and everything in front of the building. And that was the idea, was that when you drove down, if you turned off of Highway 20 and you drove down Metcalf Street, the lighting standards and the striping and the parking spaces and the sidewalk layouts and all of those kinds of things tied it to the old downtown, but we never made the decision of is there going to be an architectural style for along both sides of it. So there is room there to play our hand at it. So.
I'm kind of tempted to preserve what we have and in the blue area, but not limit things as much for new construction outside of that, just because, I mean, cost, weather, you know, things like that. I kind of like you said, it wouldn't actually be historic to build buildings like that are not, I mean, they didn't exist back then. So, I mean, outside of that, but.
So one option we have is for you guys to really chew on this, and we can talk about it next time.
Mm-hmm. Especially if we're going to make it perfect.
And, you know, I might like to throw some stuff about lighting in there too.
Yeah, I like that idea about the lighting. Definitely
lighting
keeping
I like
that
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The point just being that you don't have to have everything look the same to have something look cohesive, I guess is the point I'm making. Yeah, and that's kind of what we agreed on. And we didn't get beyond to styles of buildings and stuff like that, but we did get to the point where, like, if we can make our street scheme and our lighting scheme and all of that the same, then what happens along the way with the buildings maybe isn't quite as important, other than the historic buildings in the downtown core along that stretch. So
I guess I'd kind of hate to preclude, you know, something else going in like Abbott's Alley, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that somebody wouldn't want to do that with a flat roof. It's just, you said there's definite issues with that on residential. So. Mm.
Yeah.
I have nothing to say. But I think we're going to continue on with this. We're not going to make a motion tonight to recommend what's here. We're going to discuss it a little bit further. Is that the consensus here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Suggestion. So way back when we were doing our central business district map, which I started drawing by myself and thinking about all this, beautiful. Why don't we make inside the blue zone historic downtown? Mm-hmm. And outside of the blue zone, you could start, because I like the buildings, the library and the other buildings like that. So that would give you West Ferry, where the old Ford, they could build something like that there. Mm-hmm. But basically from the tracks to here, we would keep as historical. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if we could just plug in certain attributes.
I think you could change the wording in your, just where you're saying the West to State and blah, blah, blah. Just
yeah,
change.
So what I would be able to do is leave it like number 7, just, and then I also have a definition of downtown core in the definitions, and change the definition from what it is now and just leave it exactly it is, except stop it when it starts talking about the streets that West Ferry, Metcalf, and West State, and just leave it as the blue line.
Me being a very historic person and wanting to preserve all of that, I believe inside this blue is our historic area.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, I mean, you're saying you think Ferry's kind of the entrance to the town. I don't think that's true anymore just because everybody's coming in on the 9 and State Street. I guess it just depends. But I don't have any issue with the more northern.
Oh, the new Northwest, you mean?
Yeah, uh-huh. Those buildings being built on West Ferry here, like where the old Ford was. Mm-hmm. I think it would look good. I don't know. That's just my opinion. I just think you should shrink it to that and make this also just the historic district.
And that's really what Commissioner Huggins was not really dancing around, but not really being real solid on it.
Well, I didn't want to pin it down, but yeah, that's, yeah, because that's where the old buildings are, is in there.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that as well? You'd be good with.
I would second that.
Mm-hmm. I'd be good with it.
Joe too. I don't know. Joe, do you have any opinion on what we're talking about?
Yeah, I agree with Danielle and Stacy of narrowing down the roof part of the conversation to the Central Business District. And, I mean, the horses are already out of the barn as far as going outside there. We've got the library and such that are already Northwesty style, and I think we should continue with that theme, I guess, along with what Pat was saying. So I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah, I'm feeling a pretty good consensus that we'll just keep it to the historic blue line.
Yeah. Yeah. And just so you know, it's not that I'm married to the Northwest style. I'm just using that because a lot of it's getting built these days. So
yeah,
I'm just using it as the example. But yeah.
Well, and I think sticking to what we're talking about here in our standards of how we want the things for the historic district, if we just shrink it into that blue, what did we call that one? Just the Central Business District as the historic district as well.
Great. Okay, so number 7 is solved. I think we've heard strongly from the Planning Commission that we just keep it within the blue line. That's actually nice and simple. I think that's very reasonable. Okay.
Can I add that, you know, I think the lighting would be a good idea to be extended down.
Yeah.
West Ferry and West State, and my reason being, and maybe even all the way up Metcalf too, although I'm a little on the fence about that, is that those are kind of draws into the downtown, which I know is important, not just to the council and to the mayor, but I know to other people as well, including especially downtown business owners, having that, mm-hmm. there's not always that natural draw. I mean, this property right here kind of prohibits that. So, you know, having that lighting brings continuity and helps also transition mm-hmm. From whatever it is that we're going to have outside that blue line to what is in the blue line. So that would be my add.
I personally really like that idea.
So I think lighting would be another section. So if we want to get into lighting, you know, that wouldn't fit in under, you know, when you're talking about lighting, you're talking about street lighting.
Right, street lighting, yeah.
So that wouldn't fit under general storefront profile. That would be
right.
Not even under building design. That would be under...
I think there is a section on lighting, isn't there, or lighting standards?
We have a section for sign lighting.
Right.
Yeah.
It was also within this blue line.
Yeah.
So another question for that is, whose responsibility is that? Is that the developer's responsibility to have those installed? Or, because I mean, those those street posts are city property, right? I mean, they're maintained by the city. So is that a standard that we're putting upon the city, or is that something that is
a little bit of both?
Okay.
So when the Oaks building was developed over on Metcalf, we had Planning Commission was also a design review at that time. We don't do that anymore because it was too much hardship on the developers to have to wait a month to have a meet with the Planning Commission, and there was a lot of unsurety about how the process would go when you're spending a lot of money. So we ceased that. But as part of that process, we did require them to put in decorative street lighting. And if we wanted to continue decorative street lighting down Metcalf's or Murdoch Street, it would be probably up to the city to do so, unless other properties developed along that area.
Or you did a ULID if you got all the owners to say, "Hey, let's up the look and do the thing." Yeah.
And then we get into a whole another can of worms about what lighting is approvable, because there are a lot of lighting options.
Oh yeah.
And the ones that we have in our downtown are beautiful, but terrible.
Usually money suck, right?
They don't put out any light. They would be very expensive to make today. Like prohibitively so for a Cedro Woolley developer. You know, maybe if you're developing in downtown Seattle, you can put that kind of money, that kind of ask on somebody, but those would be too expensive. So cohesiveness can become an issue as, you know, one property develops. Say we had that requirement, Abbott's Alley would have had to have put a couple in when they did there. Mm-hmm. So now there'd be two sitting there, or even one maybe, because it's pretty short frontage.
Pretty for short frontage, yeah.
And you have no cohesiveness because Homer's not building it over, going to do it over at his place unless he tears down or redevelops. We're not going to do it here because we're already built.
I thought you had them out front.
So
maybe I'm wrong.
Where the next one might pop up down, you know, south of Coho, if that property down there develops. So you run into a continuity issue. If the city were to do it, it would make a lot more sense, and it'd be very expensive. But then there wouldn't be part of it at design standards. But if it's important for the, you know, if you think about it on West Ferry, if somebody develops the Ford dealership, yeah, it makes sense to have some, if they were to do both sides of the road, you would want those lights to be, have some continuity, and they would be able to do so. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe we write it in such a way if you're going to develop an area over a certain amount of frontage, then you have to put in decorative street lights. Mm-hmm. I'm just spitballing here. Why don't you guys go? I'm sorry, I'm stealing.
No, it's an interesting point. I was aware of that because we had trouble at some point. They were talking about just doing away with the downtown lights, and everybody decided that they were too much a part of the Cedro Woolley look to not have them, but that the lights were almost prohibitively expensive to operate. And I think they put in some kind of less expensive bulbs to operate.
Yeah, we got LEDs in them now.
Yeah, yeah, but they're still expensive to.
Well, I mean, if one breaks, like getting a new globe is not all that easy.
Okay.
I mean, it's not all that hard, but it's, you know, those things are expensive, and we own those ones.
Yeah.
That's different. A lot of lighting is owned by PSE, and we just have a franchise agreement for them to maintain it.
Mm.
So street lights are a whole other thing.
Okay.
They get expensive.
But they are important because it's very welcoming at night. If you're coming up Metcalf, it looks great. Mm-hmm. I mean, so anybody coming into the city, they actually know that, hey, that's the downtown. I mean, people coming up Highway 20, all you see is the industrial area, and you're like, what is this place kind of thing? You come on Metcalf, it looks beautiful. Yeah, it really does.
It's already bright enough on Metcalf. Even if you don't know the city and you come underneath the trestle, you're going to turn to the right because it's bright.
Yeah.
And it draws you in. So But I take John's point that there'd have to be some mechanism to make it happen for smaller developers. For the larger ones, you could probably get it from them, but the larger or the smaller ones, you might have to have some kind of a fund through the chamber or something like that, or a loan system or something for lights and signage and that kind of stuff to make it work.
And your points are kind of why I was really hesitant about the whole straight-up Metcalf. But, I mean, the West Ferry just, in my mind, lends itself to that. Because if you're – those big lots I don't think are going to develop piecemeal. I think whoever's going to buy them is going to buy them all and is going to develop all of it. So I'd imagine that would be – like the most prime location to have such a standard. Even West State Street is a little bit, I think it's easier to justify it than northern part of Metcalf, but definitely the West State Street. But I don't know if that's just being too pinpoint.
Yeah. Yes and no. These are design standards. You were saying we're really in the weeds now? The design standards are the weed patch in which you pay attention to the weeds.
Yeah.
Like everything is in there, so yeah, spot down to mullions, right? I mean, we're talking about the minutiae here. So it is appropriate for you to be discussing these things in this element, in this section of the comp plan, or the design standards.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not suggesting this. I'm just saying that I've been to several places. One, Seaside in South in Carolina, and Centennial in Florida, and Steamboat Springs, Colorado is another one where they have they carry it all the way through the community. I mean, even out into the residential areas, you have a streetlight standard, you have signage standards. So I think. We wouldn't be unreasonable to say that we're going to do it down three streets in town, basically. You know, the West Ferry, West State, and Metcalf. That's not being crazy with it. You know, but it's very nice. You know, you go to those cities and they feel very very cohesive everywhere you go. You know, you're in Centennial. You know, you're in Seaside or whatever. So, I think it's a good look, and I think we're being reasonable. It's not like we're asking it to be everywhere in town. So
that would be a way of tying in the areas where even if you have a different architectural type outlying the blue line, that is one component that really would tie things together. Because especially at night, I mean, that is such a visible aspect of wherever you're at in any community. That and there's so many different materials too. That there's different ways to mimic kind of what you have right here on Metcalf.
Mm-hmm.
But lighting, yeah, is a big deal.
Yeah.
We're going to get into the nits now.
John wants to get rolling because we've got two other things you have to read to us, right? First readings or whatever.
I think this is important. So do I bring something back saying what I think I'm hearing is cohesive lighting required for larger developments, at least on West Ferry Street?
Yeah.
Should I bring something like that?
Yeah. I'm in for that. So
Joe Frenette doing? Is he nodding? Are you nodding?
I'm driving up and down the roads on Google Map, and right now I'm going up and down Ferry. And the major difference I see between the two areas is Ferry looks very industrial with high, like three-phase wire everywhere, crisscrossing everywhere. You know, I suppose all that's going to have to go underground someday, but I don't even see where you could put street lighting up along there. So it's going to have to go through some major changes before it starts looking anything other than industrial right now.
So the street lights that we would be talking about would be about 12 to 15 feet tall. I'm not entirely sure the style. They're not super tall. They're the ones that stand decorative in. If you're on the second story window, you're looking out at them. We would still, as part of any development, require street lights. You know, the typical cobra head off of telephone poles and those kind of things. Then
yeah.
Those would all still probably be there unless, you know, we came up with a plan where these decorative lighting could achieve all of the safety needs but the overhead power lines would not preclude development of street lights of any type on the city streets.
Okay. I don't think you could do anything about that anyway, as far as that substation and all the high power stuff. That's a major utility for a real pretty wide area.
But if you drive up and down Metcalf, you see very few overhead light. Power lines. Nothing parallel to the street, just a few across the street. But Ferry's the opposite. There's tons of wires going up and down. Just looking at the differences, what it would look like. And there's street lighting, but they're, you know, 1950s or 60s.
I guess what we're driving at is it something the Planning Commission wants to see? If someone develops along West State Street, would the Planning Commission like to see cohesive decorative street lighting similar to but totally different than the street lights that you see on Metcalf Street downtown now? The idea being...
Yeah, I'm all in favor of the cohesiveness. I'm just trying to look at the practicality of it, but yes, I'm all in favor. Can you do an impact lighting fee on new construction?
Well, it couldn't be an impact fee, but I'm wondering if we couldn't create a special fund that would be a code revision to require to contribute to the downtown lighting fund. The other option is when somebody comes in and develops the old Ford dealership, they're just required to put those improvements in the right of way.
Yeah, you just made me think of another one, and I don't remember when it happened, but maybe when they did the sidewalks. At one point, they redid all the sidewalks up and down Metcalf, and I think that was at the point where they said that all electrical had to be underground, and I don't think you can do that with those big Puget Power feeding lines that are 60 feet up. But the local stuff right along the street, right along the street, that stuff all went underground when they put the sidewalks in, and that's something else we should probably think about when we're doing this lighting and everything, is that that we would probably want to put the street side lighting and power and everything underground, especially for the big projects again, because yeah, you guys did it on this building here, right? The power comes in, and then when it goes in front of your building here, it goes underground, and then it comes back up again because they didn't want to do the whole street just to build your building here. So
it's expensive to put stuff underground.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were in the way of our building facade too, so just kind of had to do it.
Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is you'd like to see a lighting section. I'll put something together for next time. Okay. So let me jump back to our roof discussion because we didn't quite close it out. We solved number 7, but I want to make sure that number 8 and number 9 are okay for the Planning Commission because those also have significant impacts. So what this says is buildings over two stories anywhere in the CBD, but outside of the historic area, defined by the blue line, must have a flat roof or a roof that can be obscured by a parapet, or are allowed to have shed roofs. So no hip roofs, no gable roofs, just flat roofs with parapets or shed roofs like the Abbott's Alley buildings.
Low slopes, yeah.
And again, it requires a 3-foot eave on the street facing side. So I'm not entirely sure if even Abbott's Alley has a 3-foot eave. Maybe I could step outside the door and go measure real quick. So what does the Planning Commission think about that? And this is just for buildings that are over two stories.
So we're defining the downtown core as inside the blue line.
Right. So this would apply.
This is outside. No.
This would apply to West State Street. This would apply to West Ferry.
West Ferry. West Woodworth. Rita.
So that's the only difference with 8 is that it would. No, I'm confused.
So
isn't it basically going to just be 7 now, except for that it's for two-story buildings?
So 7 was just for the downtown core.
Okay.
Everything's got to have flat roofs, basically.
Okay.
Now we're moving on to other parts of the CBD that are not in the historic core.
Okay, in the CBT. Okay, it's kind of written a little weird, but outside of the, okay.
Yeah. So if you're over two stories anywhere outside the historic area, you'd be required to have a low pitch roof with a parapet, or you may have a shed roof with a minimum of a 3-foot eave on the street side.
Well, I kind of think when we were talking about 7, we pretty much were allowing different style roofs now to be outside of the historic and not flat roofs at all. Or, I mean, well, I guess if they want to put one, but I doubt they want to.
Well, a lot of commercial buildings will still go with a flat roof.
Okay. Absolutely. But we're no longer requiring them.
Not outside of the CBD.
Right.
So we're talking about outside of the CBD, but tall buildings, only buildings over two stories. Mm-hmm. So a three-story, a four-story building, possibly a 5-story if you can keep it under 60 feet. That would definitely be a flat roof, so we don't need to worry about that. But so this is for taller buildings.
And you'd say
flat roof or a shed roof.
And you think it would be obvious just because they want to get the maximum out of the height, and so they wouldn't go.
Well, a 5-story building. If you're gonna make a 5-story building and keep it under 60 feet, there's no way you can do that unless you have a fire.
Right. Okay, that's not.
And that's required because of our fire things and stuff.
Yes,
it's part of it, right?
That's our ladder truck.
Yeah.
Max.
So the reason you did 8 was just, so 7 is inside the CBD or the blue line or whatever. 8 is outside the blue line over, and 9 is outside the CBD under 2. Okay. So you just broke it down that way.
Am I understanding correctly, though, that the blue line itself or the stuff inside is downtown core, but we're still defining. The only reason we have 8 and 9 is because we're still talking central business district, just outside.
Yeah,
because otherwise there's no point in even having.
That's what I was thinking at first, too, but now I understand. So.
No, I don't think we need the limit outside the.
I don't either.
Outside the blue line. I think it's whatever they design, you know, if they are more concerned about the getting the max out of the property.
Standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
But, you know, maybe not roof standards, but you definitely need design standards.
Right.
So maybe this is just a suggestion. But maybe if on 8 we said buildings up to 3 stories, it has to be the shed or the flat. Above 3 stories, it's not going to matter because you're not going to see it from the street anyway with a parapet. And then 9. Yeah, don't wait for me. I got to read. But anyway, I think eight. You just need to have. You just have to say 3 stories or above. It can be whatever, and 3 stories and under. It has to be the slope or the shed.
So, am I correct in that the point of this is to preclude hip roofs or other roof designs and then guide shed roofs, you know, with having the eaves on it and stuff. Didn't you have one that also said pitch?
The idea was this is a commercial area and we don't want it looking like a residential area. So when you have hip roofs, gable roofs, you look like a single family house. We want this to look like a commercial area. And that's why I wrote this with an eye towards not allowing standard single-family roof styles. Because you don't see it on commercial buildings.
No.
I mean, you see it incorporated in some parts, but they generally don't look like a single-family house.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So maybe it would be easier to write just what they can't do.
Maybe. What do you suggest?
What you just said.
Can't look like a single family residential.
That would be an example of a very loose,
big
standard where, like, you know, when you see it, can't look like a single-family house, which the intent is clear, and I think that's really helpful. But when someone's designing their house, their building, and they're like, they'll just, if they want to do something, what we see people do is say, that doesn't look like a single-family house. And they say, a single-family house can look like a flat-roofed 50s Rambler. It could be. So.
Okay. I just thought it would be easier in a way, but I guess not.
It would be, but it leads to arguments.
Yeah. So Abbott's
and we never win arguments.
Yeah. It's one of the saddest things for me working on the Planning Commission is that as someone who's trained as an architect, I want to leave as much wiggle room as possible for designers to do their thing, and yet they take advantage of it. So you have to have everything nailed down, and so it's like, oh my God. So anyway, learn to live with it.
So then with the roofs, Abbott's Alley, is that something that would be doable then with these?
If you like it and you think it's appropriate, then yeah, let's allow it. I generally would think, yeah, I think those are successful. Would be Island Bank. It doesn't look bad, but it just looks like a single family house.
It looks like a single family house, yeah.
Yeah, but it's inside our thing, so.
So that would not have been allowed the way it is.
Right, and so if somebody came in and knocked it down and built something new, they wouldn't be able to do that anyway.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a new building. It was built in 2000. It's not going anywhere.
So this wouldn't preclude the roofs across the way?
It wouldn't require anybody to change anything.
But they couldn't build something similar to that then?
What do you think? Buildings 2 stories, buildings over 2 stories, but outside the downtown core shall have commercial flat roofs with parapets, or may have shed roof with a minimum of 3-foot eave on the street-facing side. So those might fit.
Okay.
The only thing keeping them is the eave may not be long
enough. Okay. Yeah. Because I was just thinking, if you're thinking single family, I mean, people, as you said, build all sorts of styled homes, and that could be considered single family roof lines. I mean, it's definitely steeper pitch than you would see on most commercial buildings.
Which is why we say,
right,
we specify the roof type,
mm-hmm, right,
meaning because, you know, the roof types are more conducive to commercial buildings.
Right.
Yeah, maybe that's where we draw the line, is that a shed roof can be a commercial building or a residential building, but a hip roof is definitely residential, or a gable roof is definitely a residential looking element for larger buildings. And so that would allow a sloped roof like Silas is over here, Abbott's Alley. Sorry, I'll use the name like Abbott's Alley. But so it can be used for both, basically, but it still looks more commercial. I mean, that looks to me that those buildings look very industrial, not commercial necessarily, but they look very industrial and not so residential. But it's only got one pitch, you know, the shed roof. So maybe that's where we draw the line and say that the building has to be flat or a pitched roof and not be so set on the angle. Because I think Silas set his for solar. I think he thought he'd put solar. In fact, he does have solar panels on him, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. So he set his angle for the solar, so he didn't have to have a bunch of racks to hold it all up. So maybe that works. I don't know.
So if that's the case, then this doesn't need to be changed.
The way I'm looking at it now,
you mean the way you've written
just
it.
Said,
sorry,
is that to me number 8 should stay the way it is.
Okay.
Because you're looking at 3 stories and up.
Yeah.
And number 9 should change a little more to what you were just saying, to just admit gable and...
flatter shed.
Yeah.
Yeah, 9's going to need to tighten up, because now the way 9 was originally would never apply to West State Street or West Ferry or Metcalf. Now, since we've changed to be just within the blue line, 8 and 9 apply to mm-hmm. those stretches as well.
Mm-hmm.
So 9 currently allows pretty much any roof type, but that's when it was really envisioned to be a 2-story on all of the non-major roads in the CBD.
Mm.
So 9 probably is going to take some changing.
Well, maybe you leave it like it is, so that's the areas outside the... So stuff in the...
Or maybe we leave it the way it is, but say, except for on... Make another one that's... Break 9 into on State, Metcalf, and Ferry, outside the blue line, and then make 10 from just everywhere else, and it's kind of who cares.
Yeah, because what I'm seeing now is inside the blue line... flat roof or low slope shed, low slope shed. Outside the blue line, over 3 stories, just flat or shed, whatever the angle of the shed, and below outside dang it, I lost my thread, but anyway.
Blue line.
So that one just would have to be tightened up a little bit to not allow the gabled or hipped.
So let me do a little thought experiment here. And now let's just think of 9 as everything besides the CBD within the blue line
and over,
and excluding State, Ferry, and Metcalf.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think of 9 like that. Just all the other places outside of the main corridors. Does 9 look okay then?
I'm thinking what's there now. So West Ferry heading would be, I guess, to the north of Eastern. That's a lot of developable land. That's where the old car dealership was, and that's a good part of it. Where West State, coming from the library, heading westbound, there's a lot of mix in there. There's residential, there's Floyd's, there's the one open lot on the right-hand side. You got the E&E property and the property next to it. They'll all lend themselves to probably three or higher, higher than two. I mean, there's some decent-sized lots down in there.
Any of those can be redeveloped.
Yeah.
So
they're going to be, too.
So that's why I'm saying, like, what I'm getting is I'm thinking of making another one, just something in between 8 and 9, just for Metcalf, State, and West Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's not worry about that for the moment. Let's just look at 9, imagining that's everywhere except for Metcalf, State, and West Ferry in the CBD. Does it look okay? So imagining I write in there, except West State, West Ferry, and Metcalf.
I'm okay with it.
I'm okay with it.
Yeah, because we're just looking down here. Just a couple places.
I think it's okay.
I'm okay with what it says. If you're excluding those, yeah, just those areas there.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at what even goes on there now.
Because that allows...
So you got this. Yeah.
That allows basically anything away from our corridors that we want to look like the downtown historic core.
Which in my mind makes it sound like maybe it'll, you know, it'd flow into the downtown. The change in how they would design would flow to the downtown. Yeah.
A lot of the lighting.
9 is not going to really matter because this is going to be, you know, off on Rita Street somewhere.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, low pressure area.
Yeah.
So, if that's okay, then we move on to what do we want Ferry, West State, and Metcalf to look like? I think we've kind of pushed this enough, and I think I have enough information. And since I'm going to bring you some street lighting for I'm going to just have for West Ferry and not Metcalf and not State, because West Ferry is the one that's going to be the easiest to get somebody to develop, because it's basically 2-3 parcels.
Agree, yeah.
So... You know, if someone does the old APP, something happens at the gas station Napa, and then all of the Ford dealer, and like, bam, like you've got almost all of that street done by three developments.
Yeah.
So,
and that's a great
West
spot.
State's going to be a lot more challenging, a lot more smaller lots. So, let's not worry about that. But I think we can achieve something big on West Ferry pretty easily.
Yeah.
So let me write something for that. Let me write something for what's going to happen on the development on West Ferry, State, and Metcalf, some design standards for that. And I'll bring you something to look at next time. Unless the Planning Commission wants to add anything more to this, I think it's... After 8, let's maybe try to get to our last couple of items.
Okay.
It's been a really good discussion. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for all your work on the
that seriously.
Too.
Thank Nicole. She did most of it.
Yeah.
Hey, John.
Thank you, Nicole.
John, not to belabor this, but I was wondering if it would be possible to add definitions for corbelling. I saw that in there. It's only mentioned once, so I don't know how important that is. But I didn't see an example of it. And I did want to say I really appreciated all the illustrations. That was really helpful. And I don't know about balustrade and kick plate. I know what a kick plate is, so might be useful. I think there is an image of kick plate somewhere in there. So
Yeah, most people know what a kickoff
yeah.
is.
So maybe on that one.
No, that's not belaboring it. Thank you. I don't mean to squash the conversation. I think I had enough on that issue. So if there's anything more about the design standards that you want to provide before we move on to make this perfect for next time, because I think next time we can make it perfect.
Yeah. And will it get...
Can I?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I just wonder if I could make one correction on page 21. And then I'll move on.
Yeah. What do you got?
The labels on the photo of the window that says Mutton and Mullions, they're the opposite. Mm-hmm. Where it's pointing to the mullions, those are the muttons. And where it's pointing to the muttons, that's the mullion.
Not the way, I understand it. A mullion, which is the one within the pane, is a slender vertical member that forms a division between units of a window, door, or screen.
Yeah, they're right. Mullions are the pieces within the glass, and the mutton is the piece between the window units.
We'll look into it more though to make sure that we're right, Joe.
Okay, because even on page 15, in top of page 15, you describe. Well, go ahead and look into it, but I think they're labeled backwards. And I even have my carpentry book right here in front of me, and I looked it up, and they are backwards.
All right, that's good to know.
And even under your definitions, it describes it the other way around on page 15.
Well, I see in number 2 on page 15, you're right. It does call a mutton the divided lights between the window panes.
Right, so, exactly. Yeah, that's what my book says, too.
We've definitely got some inconsistencies here, so we'll have to definitely look into that.
Okay, thank
we'll
you.
We'll do a word search for mutton and
mullions.
Make sure that...
Okay, is everybody satisfied that we're going to revisit this the next time and move on to new business? Are we ready for that?
Yeah, and I just wanted to ask, are we going to, so is this going to, we had nobody here tonight, or are we going to put it up for a public hearing again, or are we just going to do it?
I mean, does it hurt anything to do it as a public hearing?
No, it just... costs $200 to post it.
Oh. To post it. Oh, okay. Yeah. I was just curious. I wasn't like proposing that, but I was just curious whether it was going to come back because there was nobody here tonight.
It may or may not come back. We'll see.
Okay.
I don't think it matters because we've had a public hearing on it, and it's not going to be a drastic change between now and next time.
Right, right. There's very little change outside of lighting discussions and...
Yeah.
And I suppose the city council could have one, too, if they wanted to before they adopted it, right?
But if we're just looking at saving a couple of bucks, then, you know, there's no reason not to, so...
Okay.
I'll think about it. I don't know yet.
Save the money.
So are we ready to move on to new business? And I believe Director Freiberger is going to have the first comments on the update to the transportation element of the Cedro-Woolley Comprehensive Plan, part of the 2022 docket that we looked at our joint council and planning commission meeting. So, Mark, take it away.
He's muted.
Mark, you're on mute.
Oh.
I will start again. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening, Planning Commission members. As a part of the docketing that John recently did, as you know, we're going to be doing a number of comprehensive plan changes, one of which is Chapter 3, the transportation element. And I wanted to bring to your attention two major changes in the plan, and then there are some minor changes that I've also outlined in the memorandum. I'm going to go ahead and share screen with you. The main reason I did this for Zoom for myself. Do you see a slide called background summary information?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So this is page 5 in your packet tonight, I believe. It's the agenda that I put together. And I've just outlined the three things I'm going to talk about in a little bit of detail, and I'll be sensitive to your time tonight. First of all, page 39 of the existing comprehensive plan, policies T7.2 and 7.3, we're proposing to revise those to clarify the level of service for minor arterials. And there's a memorandum attached that was prepared under my direction by Transportation Solutions that outlines the background for our recommendation that we upgrade or that we clarify the level of service for minor arterials. Currently, we have a conflict in the policies where in one of our policies, it lists level of service D for minor arterials, and in the second one, it lists level of service C. So we want to clarify that, and this also is going to provide a tool for me to better manage the flow of the project reviews that we're currently doing within the city. So the memorandum brought a couple of things out. I'm going to move on down to the discussion part of this. Minor arterials, I'm going to show you, first of all, a picture of the roadway system within the city. Do you see a map with some colored lines on it now?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. This is the DOT functional classification map. Any roads within the city that are eligible for federal funds are required to be functionally classified under the federal system. There's a listing of those classifications on the in the table on the left. And on the right side, you can see color-coded sections of roadway in the city. Basically, the State Route 20, as it comes through town, is classified as an other principal arterial. With a level of service D as set by the state of Washington. State Route 9 coming in from the south and then joint with Highway 20 to Township and then traveling north to Sumas are both minor arterials, and they are also classified by the state as level of service D. Within our city system, the green roadways such as West State Street, Ferry Street, which there's been quite a bit of discussion about both of those tonight. Cook Road within the city limits, F&S Grade Road within the city limits, and then a section of John Liner Road, are all, and Township Street, are all classified as minor arterials. The other colored roads in the city are mostly the purple, which is a major collector. And then we have one stretch on Jones Road and East Jones Road, which is a minor collector. So I'm going to turn back to the discussion now. I'm going to give you a feel of what the roadways look like. All the other roadways in the city are considered local access. And we set we really don't particularly have a level of service for those. But under our current comprehensive plan, we have classified both the minor arterials and the major collectors. So as I mentioned, DOT has classed State Route 20 and State Route 9 through the city as a minor arterial with a level of service D. And the minor arterials that are city streets, including Cook and State and Ferry and the others we talked about, are also in the current transportation element classified both as level of service D and C. And so we're proposing to clarify that and make them all level of service D. This will accord with what the state is doing on the routes through town. It will also be in compliance or concord with what's done in the city of Mount Vernon, Oak Harbor, Skagit County, Whatcom County, Granite Falls, Sultan, Marysville. Anacortes and Burlington actually classify their minor arterials at level of service C. In that memorandum from TSI, I'm going to flip over there real quickly, they indicated the existing level of services there. They also, in the description there tell you what level of service means in terms of how that's defined. This table does that. A level of service A, which is the least delay, less than 10 seconds of delay at a signalized intersection or a stop control, that's considered free flow, the best condition. Level of service B is also a stable flow with slight delays between 10 and 20 seconds. Level of service 3, between 20 and 35 seconds. And then level of service D, between 30 and 55 seconds. It's approaching unstable flow, but still tolerable delay. And you have occasional wait through one or more signal cycles before proceeding on a signal at stop control. It's just a question of delay. And when you get into the lower level of service E and F, the delays get to where you have unstable flow at E, and then you're basically forcing the flow with a level of service F.
Hey, Mark, I have a quick question. So yes. when we bring it from a C to a D, it's like making it worse traffic, I guess, to give a simple example. Is it because that's exactly what's happening now? It gets reclassified based upon the current capacities, uses, and things like that?
So I'm going to talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
So if you'll hold your fire for just a minute, we'll do that. We have, in association with both this this element or this item on the recommendations and a second one regarding the Hodgin Road Arterial Project, I looked extensively at what's going on in particular in the vicinity of the Cook and Trail Road intersection. That's one that's got has some challenges at the peak flow or the peak hour times in the morning and the afternoon, predominantly in the PM time period at that intersection. We have some other intersections in town that have challenges too. A notable one is the intersection at Highway 9 and John Liner McGarrigle. Now that we have the money and are selecting consultants tomorrow to design a signal to replace that stop controlled intersection on the side streets. Which should help significantly with that. The other end of what is our Jones-John Liner Trail Road Corridor projects is Cook and Trail. And I'll give you a map showing some things on that in a few minutes. And we are actively pursuing funding of the Cook Trail project. I didn't bring a graphic for you tonight. I could do that next time if you'd like to see it. But we've made significant progress on moving that corridor forward. And one of the things that's included in that are intersection improvements at the existing Cook Trail intersection, which we actually show in our six-year TIP for the year 2026. Now, we don't have funding for that yet, but we are accumulating developer impact fee money towards that and the other projects on the route. And we have a pretty good plan in place on how to make that happen over the next few years. In fact, over the next 3 weeks, I'm writing yet another grant request to try to fund the entire project through the $1.5 trillion transportation program that was passed by the U.S. Congress in 2021. We'll be submitting that for consideration. So this whole discussion of level of service comes into play in the fact that as we've updated our transportation model and looking at growth and projections related to the corridor project and also the development that's taking place around town, specifically in the vicinity of Hodgin and Stendel in there, we've been concerned about where that was heading and the timing of the projects. And so I've had TSI look very carefully at how that might transpire over the next few years, and is our TIP plan adequate to manage the traffic growth that we're seeing? And another thing that you're observing in town is that there is significant through traffic growth happening right now. Just today, I had comments made to me in staff meeting regarding the backup of traffic on Highway 20 east of the township intersection there. And by the way, we are rebuilding that intersection this summer, starting in June, late June. We'll be revising the signal at that intersection to add dedicated turn pockets for all four legs. We have on one now, but that'll give us dedicated on four. That's going to help significantly with that. But the traffic flow is increasing. The through flow of traffic is increasing on Highway 20 and east of town coming in, and also west of town going out to I-5 on both Cook and on Trail. So that's all in my mind as I'm talking about these things. So level of service, why is that important? It's a tool that we use in terms of managing our growth in the city. We have to operate under concurrency. That's a term that's used extensively in the comprehensive plan, and it comes out of growth management, so that we have to be able to demonstrate when we approve these projects, the major projects at least. It doesn't really apply to ones that are under our threshold for a traffic impact analysis requirement. That's fewer than 50 vehicle trips per day, peak hour. That's actually per day in that case. So when we look at those and we look at growth, we need to be able to determine what does that do to the level of service of the roadway segment and of the intersections in the vicinity. So we've had a number of those done recently with the BYK proposed development at the intersection of Stendhal and Trail, with the 76-unit, five-story building that RJ Group is doing over on Stendhal and Hodgen Road. And they have other things coming in the pipeline as well. In fact, I can show you, it's getting a little ahead of my talk, but it's appropriate with your question. This is a picture of what I've been tracking in that area, and John and I have talked about this extensively. We have a number of developments that are all affecting the traffic growth in this area. This is the Cook Trail existing intersection, and as you know from driving by there, there's a gas station being built at that intersection currently. Granite Holdings recently completed a 28-unit townhome development just to the east of the intersection, and there's a second 28-unit one that basically mirrors that. That's in the final process of approval, and it will be starting yet this summer. North of the intersection, you're probably aware of the Bucco development. We have just entered in with the Bucco family with a developer's agreement for a phased development of that property. That will, as a part of that developer agreement, will build a section of the new Jonestown Line or Trail Road Corridor project, which basically will skirt the school district property here, their bus transit facility, and come up the east side of that through a property we bought, and we were through a series of boundary line adjustments with the school district and the requirements for the roadways within the Bucco parcel. That will actually push the roadway up to tie into the roadway section that was built by BYK between FNS and Jones, and so that particular development will result in 68 single-family and duplex units in there, and then they have an additional 5 acres that you've seen already in terms of a rezone request. They're requesting a residential rezone for this commercial property here. That we've seen no plans on anything for that. That's all totally dependent on how council decides on that request. So that's in the vicinity of the intersection. There's another 24-unit development that's I believe's been submitted just to the west of the intersection. This is the BYK development I mentioned at 820 Trail, and the properties here in green and blue are all the RJ Group developments. And then finally, there's a proposed Starbucks that will be going in at the intersection of Trail. Of Hodgen and Highway 20 down here. And what these do and how we're metering these in, we're looking at the peak hour trips. And this is a table that comes from one of TSI's products on how that's going to grow the traffic in this area. I mentioned that they've produced traffic analyses associated with the bigger projects, the first section of BYK's project and the first section of RJ Group have both done that. And they've looked at these intersections, including this one at Cook and Trail. And that's where it first got my attention, because they were showing some pretty dire drops in level of service up here, not just from their projects, by the way, but they had to measure in the impacts from the area as well. Because we are showing construction of a new intersection improvement in 2026, these projects technically meet concurrency, even though if this full development takes place over the next next number of years, next 5 years, it would drive that intersection without improvements to a level of service E, and that's down in that lower functionality range, which we need to avoid. And it actually kicks us into the point where if we were not going to build that intersection, we would have to slow this development down in some manner. It couldn't happen until the intersection was improved. But because it is planned, they do have the ability to come forward with their projects. We'll be looking at mitigation measures on those things as well. Technically, they are paying traffic impact fees, which support the projects, including the intersection improvements we've allowed here. So that's a factor in all this as well. So the level of service thing, how that relates here, this intersection is operating at a level of service C currently. And that's the delay that's under 35 seconds, I believe, in the chart I showed you earlier. It does have challenges in the peak hours. Currently, it's difficult to make a left turn from Trail Road to Cook in the p.m. peak hour and the a.m. as well. But it is functioning adequately. And we had a recent update to the model, as I mentioned, and we actually did traffic counts again because the data we had was for the prior model was from 2015 for our comprehensive plan, and 2019 was the data collection that was done by RJ Group and BYK's traffic modeler. So we've got current data on this, very comfortable with saying this still operates at a level of service D. We do see in the analyses that are coming up that that's going to degrade. This is from the model, the analysis that was just completed on March the 7th, shows the intersection at 20 and Trail operating at a level of service B on all motions except for southbound through 20, currently in 2022, overall at a B, and it shows Cook and South Trail at an overall level of service C. The other intersections are pretty much not a problem that we're studying. This is a table that's in that memorandum that shows how we cranked in the various developments that are coming up, and this is the same numbers you saw on that map that I showed you a minute ago. And then finally, what happens after that development all takes place, and that's where the rubber meets the road. It shows that the SR20 and Trail Road intersection will still operate at a level service B after all 611 of those trips are built out. But it shows that the Cook Road, Trail Road, South Trail Road intersection would go to a level service E without improvement. It will operate at a level of service D through 2025, and it breaks from level of service C to D about 2024, depending on how fast that development actually takes place. So part of the reason that I am interested in having this clarified in the comp plan to a D rather than a C, it allows me the ability to continue to move these projects forward in some manner, looking forward to building the new intersection improvement in 26 that will prevent this from happening. What happens with the intersection if it's rebuilt as a roundabout, which is what our current plan is this, these all change to a level of service A. And it will work at that level of service for at least 20 years after that. So anyway, that's important to keep in mind. And the other thing that I've been kind of beating the drum on with council is while, you know, we could take a hard line with development and stop that altogether, we still are facing the background traffic that is coming through town that is stressing these intersections already. In addition to this traffic that you see that I showed you in the table in the immediate vicinity of that, we have the other traffic developed by developments up on North Portobello. The golf course is looking developed. And there's a lot of background development in town that falls below the radar of doing these traffic studies. Plus, all the through traffic that's going on is having a background effect that we're going to go to level of service D on the Cook Trail Road intersection, regardless of the development in the immediate vicinity of that within the next several years. What I'm saying by that is we've got to build that intersection improvement, whether or not we grow internally. The tool that we have for building these projects are traffic impact fees and real estate excise tax fees. So we need that, we need those funds to be able to seek grant funding to build these projects. And so it's really important that we need to be able to move forward in a coordinated manner. So on the basis of that, that's staff's recommendation that we clarify our level of service as level of service D for our minor arterials. It would stay at level of service C for the major collectors and the minor collectors. Do you have any questions on that before I go on to Hodgin? I'll be touching on some of the same things as I go through that as well.
You know, so if I interpret this correctly, when we go from a C to a D, we then qualify for different funding sources to improve that level of service going forward.
You know, the funding sources are not really affected by that other than we, for instance, like with TIB, we will tell them what the traffic issues are at these. This was a big factor in our funding for John Liner and Highway 9 intersection. We demonstrated to them that the day that the new corridor opened, that intersection would go to a level of service F. That's because of the vehicles trying to make the turns from Highway 9 to John Liner would have very significant delay. And so they were appreciative of that argument, and they did fund that intersection on a capacity basis, even though it's looking forward to the project that's not built yet.
Right.
We've been able to demonstrate that we're making significant progress on that with the BNSF Undercrossing Bridge, the work that we've negotiated with Bucco on the on their track, and the work that BYK has already completed. So, you know, we've got a lot of things moving forward on this, and it's really important that we need to be able to continue with that and continue to have the funds come in to make this happen in a coordinated manner.
Thank you.
Mark?
Okay, Joe? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Commissioner Frenette had a question.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you're very thorough, and I appreciate it. I just wonder if there's someone as diligent as you are that works for the state that's looking at what's down the road towards the freeway with what's going to happen to those intersections. Someone working on that simultaneously?
Yes, they are. They've done an intersection analysis at the highway or the I-5 and Cook Road intersection. That's probably what you're alluding to.
Right.
They've got some plans that they're working on for that. They're planning to do two additional lanes crossing the railroad tracks there to allow for more capacity through the intersection and some signal modifications to coordinate that with the on and off ramps at the intersection. That should greatly assist on that. In fact, the preliminary studies, I was on a group that came up with the plan to do that some years back, and they're actively seeking funding for that as well. They don't have it yet, but they know it's a problem, and they are looking at it. Problem with working with an agency like DOT is they have other intersections that have equal problems up and down the corridor, so it's just getting their attention about this one being the highest priority, and it is the highest priority in Skagit County, as I understand it, although they've got some issues within the Mount Vernon area as well at a couple of those intersections there also, but yes, they are looking at these things.
Thank you.
So Hodgin Road is the other one that I'd like to talk to you about. In our project list, it's a part of the transportation element. We've got a list of, I don't know, there's 40 or so projects in there that we envisioned over the next 20 years to manage the traffic growth within the city of Cedro Woolley. We have things like the Jones-John Liner Corridor. That is a prominent set of projects within that project list. We've got one that's called the Hodgen Road Arterial Extension. I'll show you a picture of that now. That's been in there since before I got here. Originally, in the 2005 transportation plan, the vision was to push Hodgen Road through in some manner to Cook Road and then continue it up through the farmland out to match basically Jones Road and then connect into what was already planned in the 2005 plan to put the Jones-John Liner Corridor in place.
And Mark, one sec, Mark. If the Planning Commission is looking for this graphic, it's also on the last page of Mark's memo. So sorry to interrupt, Mark.
Thank you, John. Yes, it is there, and it's probably a little easier to read than what I'm showing you. I have been, since I got here in 2007, I've been looking at this. They actually had, the city had some money to move forward with a design for this extension at that time, and I actually squashed that. I stopped the project because I thought it was way premature with no plans whatsoever at that time for extending this project through and some other major elements that I saw that were issues. So where this comes into play right now, let me find the right spot here. Here's the five concerns that that I had then and now that are still true. That the first is that alignment would require a crossing of Brickyard Creek at an angle, and there's some environmental issues that are pretty prominent on trying to do that. The second is there is a protected farmland west of Brickyard Creek that would have to be dealt with in any kind of building of this. The third is that the Cedro Woolley High School has baseball fields just north of that route that would also be impacted by that alignment. The fourth is that it would require a double curb, which you saw in that sketch, and I'll turn back to that in just a minute, over a short distance, which is not a good idea in an arterial like this. And the fifth is that the removal of this extension from the let me go back to the map and show you this last one. I mentioned that a future extension that was in our comprehensive plan back in 2005 to extend this route to Jones. In the 2016 transportation plan, there was significant opposition from the public for that project to the extent that Planning Commission actually voted to remove that from the comprehensive plan. That is no longer in the comprehensive plan. And I was hesitant about that, but that was the decision made, and council agreed with that in the final approval of the 2016 plan. Without that extension there, this arterial really has no long-term purpose in my mind. It does serve to take some traffic pressure technically off the intersection at Cook and Trail. So in order to make sure I wasn't missing any rocks I needed to turn over, I had TSI also do an analysis that looked specifically at this intersection and looked at whether or not the building of this route would allow us to extend the lifespan of that intersection. And the short answer is no, it does not. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is logistical. That is, because we put this in the long-term parts of our plan, it's not likely that this would be built, if ever, any earlier than 2036. So it would have no immediate impact on that intersection. So knowing that, the other thing I looked at, well, if we did get it in there somehow early, would it take enough pressure off of this intersection to allow it to continue to function at a level of service C or D for a significant period of time? And the answer is no. The trip diversion that would use this route up here is small enough that we would still get to the breakdown point on this intersection virtually the same time. So the conclusion that I've come to on this, and TSI agreed with me on this, is that we are better off to focus our efforts on funding and building that intersection improvement in 2026, or sooner if possible, but I don't think it is sooner possible to do that sooner. And the reason I say that is the important things to concentrate are the improvements that make up the Jonestown Liner Corridor, and getting those done. And that is part of those projects, but it's the one that's kind of at the end of the road there. We really have to have those improvements in place before we open this corridor up, because the additional traffic would come down this route, would basically make that intersection go to a level of service, the day it opened up. And by the way, that's included in all these analyses that we've been doing. So it's all tied together such that they really need to work in lockstep. I'll mention also that when this, the possibility of building this route was removed from consideration, that's when I got busy and came up with an alternative to build this section down to connect into Trail Road. And we do have an alternative way of getting that traffic back here that will serve our traffic studies for the corridor project. And these improvements we're talking about at Cook and Trail will allow this to function for at least 20 years and beyond. So it looks like that all works pretty well. The long and short of it is there any practical reason to continue to look at building the Hodgin Road arterial extension? My conclusion is no. I think it's basically going to be impossible to build it, or nearly so, because of the farmland impacts we have down here. That's protected farmland, and the school district impacts here. I'll just mention to you that it does benefit the developer of this parcel, the RJ Group parcel. They wouldn't have to dedicate or build that section of roadway. It does benefit them. They would have more developable land. And we're looking at a SEPA mitigation is the way to do that, to recognize that benefit for them. And they've already offered to participate in the building of this project in recognition of that. So what we see out of this is a real win-win situation that allows us to move the most important project in our planning, which is this intersection improvement at Cook and Trail, forward in a manner which will allow us to build that in lockstep with whatever development we see in the area. We'll still have the ability, as we review these developments as they're coming up, if for some reason this project is delayed, then they would have to delay further development as well. We know from the charts I'm showing you here that there's a breakdown point that'll come in about 2 years. We'll operate it at a level service B through 2024. After that, if there's continual development and we don't have in place that plan, if we're not already designing this intersection by that time, then we're going to have to put the brakes on. And we have the ability to do that through the process that we have. So it's one of those things that it's a real chicken and egg thing that we're looking at. We really need to allow some development to keep the impact fees and the real estate excise tax things coming into the coffers to have the money to build these projects. But we also necessarily need to look carefully at how this intersection performs in the meantime and not let it get below the level of service B. So anyway, that's the long and short of what I wanted to say to you tonight. This is your first look at it, and of course council is going to have the same look at this as well. And all of this stuff is fairly complicated, and ask me all the questions you want to. I know it's late tonight. I will be back again and we can talk about it more. So any more questions on that?
You know, what's daunting is what it is at the end of the day. Before I moved in town, I lived on Trail Road, and that's back in 2014. It was bad then. So what's going in right now and what continues to go in? Yeah, if that solution at Cook and Trail doesn't start sooner rather than later, it's just going to be a bad situation for all the new construction going in there, because right now you're in lockdown.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you.
It's challenging right now, but that's not the only place in town, of course.
You know, no, no.
Intersection at Highway or Township and 20, same thing. Traffic backing up all the way out past the pizza joint out there now, and has been for several years. I don't think anybody really forgets, but you know, prior to COVID in 2020, the traffic was just as bad as it is today out at that intersection. That's why I was planning that intersection improvement back then. We've been seeking that money for, we have actually had that money since 2019. We have turned Payne's federal funds to rebuild that intersection. And so that's a really necessary one. It's going to help. And of course, as I mentioned, the intersection at McGarrigle and Highway 9 is another one that has its challenges. Challenges at that intersection are different. They're really, we talked about this at staff meeting today, they're really guided more by the patterns of parent drop-off at the two schools there, which are challenges that are difficult for both us and the school district to manage. The signal is going to help, but it's not going to solve that problem. The school district's going to have to come on board and make some changes in how they do business as well to keep that functioning. So all this traffic is just kind of rolls through town, and it has two ways to go to the west. One of them is Cook Road, and the other one is Highway 20, and both of them are already fairly busy. Just to give you an idea, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 14,000 vehicles a day using Cook, and about 18 using State Route 20 right now. And so they're busy roads.
Anyone else? Mark, thank you. It's always enlightening for me just to watch the changes, and then you have the seasonality aspect of it after Memorial Day, that we pick up a lot of vacation traffic on Highway 20, which makes it even crazier on a Sunday night.
Yes, it does. It does. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
So it's almost 9 o'clock. Do we want to take up the updates to the Capitol facilities next meeting?
Nope. Do it today.
Okay. Okay, I'm okay with that.
It's 5 minutes.
Okay, that's fine.
Not much to do.
Chairman Johnson is going to recuse himself at this particular point in the discussion. So we will see you later. We won't say a word until you're out the door.
Enjoy. We can talk. He just can't participate.
He wants to leave.
Well, so to finish up on the
on
the transportation issue, today was the first read. We'll do a second read and public hearing at the next meeting. And then the new one, this next one is Capitol... comprehensive plan amendment number 2 for the year of 2022. And this is a request from the school district to update their capital facilities plan. If you read the memo, you know that the school capital facilities plan is embedded into our capital facilities element. So it's kind of a strange routine where whenever the school district updates theirs, we have to then update our capital facility plan in order to incorporate it. And, you know, we can only do that during the comprehensive plan cycle, so it's, timing can be really awkward. Like, they finished this in November, and, you know, we're only able to get to it now because this is when we started our docket cycle. There's not a whole lot to say about the capital facilities element. I think it's a really interesting read, and that the Planning Commission is probably interested in what it says, and I encourage you to read through it. And I think the school district will probably have a representative at the next one, maybe when we have the public hearing. Today was just an introduction day. So their capital facility plan includes their financial numbers for
how they arrive at their school impact fees. The school impact fees are used to pay for capital improvements that are reasonably associated with new development in the city, not just the city, but in the school district. We collect the impact fees on behalf of the school district. It is just a pass-through. It goes from us to them on a weekly basis. You know, as we collect a few bucks, we send it to them. And here is the new capital facilities element. It doesn't really change anything to the comp plan, our own comp plan, besides Exhibit E to the capital facilities plan. Exhibit A to this memo is the school capital facilities plan. In that, as I said, they describe how they get to their impact fee prices that they are requesting. In my memo, I talk about what the current fees are, which are $1,678 per single family home and $847 per unit in a structure with more than one unit. They're proposing that those go up to $4,461 for a single family residence and $2,888 for a multifamily. Now, we can't really do anything about what the fees that they suggest are. We really just can adopt it. We can't suggest that they change their capital facility plan and recommend higher or lower numbers. It just kind of is what it is. So this really is just a formal process that we go through in order to make it happen. When we do update the capital facilities plan to include their capital facilities plan, we also have to update our municipal code, because the fee is actually also talked about in chapter 17, or I'm sorry, 6. The fee is talked about in chapter 15.64, specifically section 040 of that, and we would need to update that to just show the new fee. And that's it. That is the procedure that we will go through. We're asking that, you know, the Planning Commission hold a public hearing at the next meeting and make a recommendation to approve. It's kind of an unfortunate process that we have to go through to make it happen, but that is the state rules, stating that if it's, you know, a comp plan update item, it has to go through the comp plan process. It is what it is. The city attorney and I have looked at myriad of other ways to make this happen easier, so that we can just adjust the impact fees as the school needs requests them, but we have not found a way outside of this process. So that's it. Unless you have questions, we'll have a public hearing on this at the next meeting.
Yep, I want to go too, but just quickly, it's never happened since I've been on here, but if...
Yeah. It's never happened since I've been on the Planning Commission, but if somebody does come to a public hearing and has requests for the school to change, we just pass them back through to them or what? Because, yeah, like I said, it's never happened.
The school district already had public hearings on this.
Right.
They've done studies, and it's gone through their process. And yeah. So now it's just an adoption process for us, which is kind of a hassle for everybody. I get it, but...
Right. That's why I was asking, because it's never happened, but if somebody did raise something at a Planning Commission meeting, we would just pass it back through to the...
We would say, you know, you had your chance to talk.
Oh,
you
see.
Had your chance to comment on the impact fees, the proposed impact fees during the school district's
public hearings. Okay.
Public hearing process.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I've spoken with one of the local developers, and they felt that the school impact fee was too low, that it needed to be raised. So I'm not expecting a lot of pushback on it.
Yeah, no, I'm not either. Like I said, nothing's ever come up before when we
reviewed. If you're a bigger developer and you're trying to market houses in the area, you want the local schools
you
to
want
be shiny
good
new
schools.
And people want to go to those schools.
Yeah.
So it is in the larger developer's interest to make sure that the schools are pretty.
And that's a fact,
and
too.
And well run.
Yeah, that's a fact. Absolutely. Good school district will absolutely impact real estate values. Okay, if we're done.
Actually, I have one more question.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm just curious about what happened to the parks impact fees. Isn't that going to be a part of that as well?
Well, this was a full agenda, so it's okay. Going to be next time.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to put too much on it. And to be honest, I didn't have time to write any more memos. I do have Planning Commission discussion items, though, before you guys go running for the door. I forgot what one of them was, but... Are we done with this then?
Yes.
If we're ready to move on?
Anything else anybody else would like to talk about? Planning discussion information items? I think we're pretty much done for the night.
Yeah, nothing here.
Go ahead. Stacy? Danielle? Joe?
I don't have anything.
Okay. So would somebody like to make a motion?
I just wanted to point out that Michelle's not here. You may or may not have heard, Michelle has retired from public service as of today. So she no longer works for the city of Cedar Woolley. And if she had retired one day later, she could have come by and said goodbye. But she retired today and did not feel the need to come to the Planning Commission tonight.
She's hanging out with Joanne.
So we're a little shorthanded at for a while until we get somebody to fill her shoes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I feel like there was one other thing I wanted to bring up, and I meant to write it down, and I didn't. But there we go. It'll have to wait till next time.
Would someone like to make a motion to adjourn?
I'll make the motion. We adjourn.
Second?
Oh, I'll second it.
All in favor? Aye.
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 adjournment, 9:01 p.m. We'll see everybody next April. Thank you.
Next April or April?
It's this April, this coming April. That was Freudian slip.
All right, so Bill, it looks like you shut off the recording. Thank you.